How's everybody?
Good.
Good. Good to see y'all. This is what I want to do. I want to have a word of prayer first, and then I want to do housekeeping, and then I want to read about Samuel and Eli and Hophni and Phinehas, and then leave and do something important. Sound good?
Good.
Excellent. So the Lord be with you.
Also with you.
Let us pray. Blessed Lord, who has caused all scriptures to be written for our instruction, teach us so to hear them, to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, so that we may embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life that you have given to us through our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom with you and the Holy Spirit be all honor and glory, world without end. Amen. So, housekeeping stuff. So we've been sort of rocky coming up just so far this spring with this class, just because of various types of things. So obviously we're meeting today.
Yay.
Guess what we're not doing next week?
Oh,
I know. Some people have heard and some people haven't. My brother-in-law, Amy's brother, died on Thursday. And so I planned on meeting, but next week is the funeral, so we're flying up to Boston to go to the funeral there. So, again. But then after that, we'll pick up.
Yeah.
And we'll give it a shot. Sound good?
Cool.
So there's the housekeeping thing. So, again, no class next week, of course. Unfortunately, in a lot of ways. So, cool. Sound good? Cool. Awesome. Just to review last, Samuel. If you remember last time, we had a story of two families, right? We read the first two chapters or so of 1 Samuel, right? And so, on the one hand, we have the family of Elkanah. I wish I had my, but anyway, I wish I had a marker. I would just mark right here. So we have Elkanah, who's the husband, who's the man of the house. So Elkanah, and he has two wives. So far, so good. There's Peninnah, and there's Hannah. Peninnah has children. Hannah doesn't have children. This causes lots of problems. Well, it causes lots of problems, not just naturally, but it causes lots of problems because Peninnah hates Hannah and tortures her every time they get together for a family get-together. She sort of tortures her. She makes fun of her because Hannah doesn't have any children. Hannah gets upset at this. Every time she gets upset at this, they happen to be at Shiloh, which is where the tabernacle is, the holy place is. She gets upset. She goes and she prays. And she meets there at the tabernacle. Out of my way, sir. She meets there Eli, who's the priest there at Shiloh. And Eli has two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. Eli, it seems to me, is a rather clueless type of person. He doesn't have any idea. He doesn't have any idea what's going on around him, nor does he have any idea about what he should be doing or paying attention to. And we'll meet him more today. You can already tell from the title that I've given this section. I don't really like Eli, but God really doesn't like Eli. So anyway, so there's Eli with his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. But anyway, Hannah goes and prays, meets Eli there, but makes a prayer to God and says, again, she's upset about all of this. And so she prays to God and says, if you'll just give me a son, this is what I'll do. This is how desperate I am to get Peninnah off my back. If you'll just give me a son, I'll get him back to you. And that is, when he's 6, 7, 8, older boy, I'll bring him here to Shiloh, and he'll serve you as a priest for all of his days. And guess what happens? She has a son, right? And she waits until he's weaned, which is about 6, 7, and she brings him, and she presents him to Shiloh, to Eli. The little boy, Samuel, is his name. The little boy becomes an apprentice Let's put it that way, right? And he learns the craft of being a priest. So that's one family. Here's the other family. Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas. Hophni and Phinehas are wicked, wicked, wicked. In fact, of all the words, at least in Hebrew, of all the words that you can call somebody in Hebrew, there is no worse word than the name Belial in Hebrew, which is exactly what the narrator two or three times calls Hophni and Phinehas. And the reason why Hophni and Phinehas are so wicked is this, and this is important because this is going to come up today. The reason why Hophni and Phinehas are so wicked is a couple of different things. First of all, they have sex with the women that serve in the tabernacle. In fact, it sounds as though they have sex right there at the tabernacle, which is exactly where Eli is supposed to be paying attention. And we'll see today, he's not paying attention. But that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is that they take those sacrifices that people are bringing that are supposed to be ways in which they have a relationship with God. Hophni and Phinehas take those sacrifices and barbecue them for their own selves. Right? They take those sacrifices and use that meat, yeah, to have a barbecue. And again, like I said last time, you understand, right? You understand that in the ancient world, you can't just sort of come to a church and pray and have a relationship with God. The whole thing is set in a situation of sacrifice. Speaking as a good Episcopalian, I can tell you that the whole thing is set up through sacrifice. But that's not important right now. The whole thing is set up through sacrifice, right? And if you mess with those sacrifices, if you profane, those of you who were with me for Leviticus a long time, if you profane, if you use those sacrifices, which are supposed to be holy, which are supposed to be special, which are supposed to be set apart so that you can have some sort of communion, interaction, relationship with God, if you take those sacrifices and you use them just like the barbecue meat, porterhouse steak, whatever, that's really, really serious. In fact, it's so serious, we'll see, it's so serious that we've got to do something. Because if this continues, the whole shebang, I mean the whole shebang, I mean all the way from Abraham, calling Abraham way back there in Genesis 12, the whole shebang is sunk. It's really desperate what's happening here with Hophni and Phinehas. So let's go ahead. So that's sort of the situation. We'll sort of set it up. Oh, I'm sorry, just one more thing. And that is last time that we read, we noticed that in the chapter 2, and today we're picking up at the end of chapter 2, but we just noticed that whenever we're talking, when the narrator starts talking about Hophni and Phinehas, and when the narrator talks about Samuel, it's like a back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It's like a light switch. Every time Samuel shows up, zoink, the light comes on and the bunnies hop and the bluebirds fly and the rainbows come out and everything's wonderful. Every time Hophni and Phinehas are there, zoink, it's dreadful. And so it's back and forth and back and forth. And again, you can't set up, in fact, in my opinion, throughout all, practically all of the stories of the Old Testament, I think New Testament as well, all the stories, there is not a bigger contrast between these two and that one. It's just set up in such a way that, again, it really is very similar to every time Samuel is mentioned, it's sweetness and light. Every time Hophni and Phinehas are mentioned, for obvious reasons, Hophni and Phinehas are mentioned, it's dreadful. So here we go. Now, Eli was very old. We can stop right there. remember that phrase, because that's going to be really, really important next time we meet, week after next. So, again, I know it's 14 days. Try to remember. Now, Eli was old. That's going to be a really important phrase next time we meet. Cool. Now, Eli was very old. Sorry, just one more thing. And that is the story that's come up before this with Hophni and Phinehas and doing all of this stuff. This is before Eli is old. This is when the young guys are sort of there and they're having the sex and they're taking the sacrifices and they're fattening themselves. Again, this isn't something that happened on Tuesday and now it's Thursday, right? This is something that's been going on for a while, maybe even decades. So again, it's not just something that they did once or twice and then God's going to zap them. This is something that's been going on for a long time. And let me think. There's Hophni and Phinehas, and they're like doing the bad stuff. But who's in charge?
Eli.
Eli's the one in charge. And I don't know if you've ever been a supervisor or something, but whenever people are doing things under you that are undermining the whole of human life, you might want to deal with it. But this has been going on for decades, and now Eli is very old. That one sentence is really important. Eli was very old, and he had heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they're lying, how they're having sex with the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he said to them, "You cursed, get out of here. You must not do this. You are no longer priests under me. You may no longer do this." He has lots of options. Notice what he does. "Why are you doing that? I'm hearing about your evil dealings from all of these people. No, my sons, it's not a good report I hear the people of God spreading about. If one person sins against another, someone can intercede for the sinner with the Lord. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can make intercession?" And this is a good indication that Eli has absolutely no idea what it's about. Because obviously, if someone sins against the Lord, who is it that's supposed to make intercession? Priests, right? Which is what he is. He has no idea what his even role is here. "But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to kill them." And yes, this sounds very Old Testament-y, this sounds very cruel, this sounds very harsh, but you have to understand, you really have to understand the nature of the evil that is being imposed here, and how it is absolutely undermining everything. It's kind of like, I don't know, again, I can't think of a modern example because we're so wishy-washy these days. But anyway, this is, again... the whole thing is being sunk right now. Over decades. I wish that bluebird would get out of here. "Now the boy Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and with people." Everybody liked him. God liked him. He's growing up. He's getting bigger. He's learning his craft. He's doing the priestly type of stuff. What we're going to have now are two stories. And there are two stories that are going to be talking about the judgment that God is going to pronounce upon Eli and his family. Okay? So, you might want to buckle your seatbelts because this is kind of chilly. Here we go. "A man of God came to Eli and said to him..." That's a really important... Sorry to keep stopping, but these stories are so beautifully crafted. That's a really important sentence. Twice, "A man of God came," where? To Eli. This is not someone standing on a street corner just sort of rambling about, the religious leadership in Israel and how we need to do something and sort of putting it on Facebook and sort of posting memes, right? No, this is someone that actually goes to Eli, and not only goes to Eli, says to him, okay? That's going to be important in a little bit. He comes to Eli and he says to him. So this is incontrovertible. What this is about. "Thus the Lord has said, I revealed myself to the family of your ancestor." And the ancestor, you can see, I put a little footnote in there. It's almost certainly Aaron, right? The head of the priests, right? And so Eli and his family are descendants from Aaron, right? "So I revealed myself to the family of your ancestor in Egypt when they were slaves to the house of Pharaoh." So a long time ago, I revealed myself to Aaron. "And I chose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar, to offer incense, to wear an ephod before me." Ephod is like an apron that you use when you're cutting up meat or something like this. It's a holy thing, though. "To wear an ephod before me. And I gave to the family of your ancestor all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel." So this is your responsibility, these sacrifices. "Why then look with greedy eye at my sacrifice. And you see, I sort of italicized greedy eye. That's going to be important in a second. Why are you looking with a greedy eye at my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded? And you honor your sons more than me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel. You see, there's two problems going on here. You can see I italicized it, right? There's two problems going on there. First of all, the priests have a greedy eye. They're looking at those sacrifices and they're wanting them for their own selves. So far, so good? Making themselves feel good. And not only making themselves feel good, but also using that to actually fatten themselves. So far, so good? And you remember the way this, and again, this is, I'm sorry to keep jumping back. You remember the way in which this works. Somebody brings up a sacrifice. There's certain prescriptions about what parts the priest can take, but they don't do that. They say, I want to take, immediately after the animal sacrifice, I want to take that and I want to roast it for my own self, right, with the fat and everything. Medium rare, right? Nice filet mignon, right? Nice and rare. That's what I want. And the people that come up, they know that this isn't right, and so they said, no, let's just take the fat off first, and then you can do. And he says, no, you give it to me now, and if you won't, I will take it by force. I'll wrestle you for those fatty pieces of the sacrifice so that I can have a barbecue. Take it by force. They're looking with a greedy eye in order that they can fat themselves. Why are you doing that? Therefore, the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promised that your family and the family of your ancestors should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, hell no. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I promised that your family was going to be priests before me. And again, family meaning all the way back from Aaron. I promised that your family is going to be priests before me forever. Now? Absolutely not. This is really important. We'll come back to this later. But I promised, but absolutely not. God keeps his promises. Well, not always. It depends on how things are going. Right? Sort of that promise is that if you sort of stay in line, right? Again, there's mercy, but you got to sort of stay in the path, or at least try. Now, absolutely not. Those who honor me are the ones that I honor. Those who despise me are going to be treated with contempt. Look, a time is coming when I will cut off your strength. And you can see the little footnote there. There's a perfectly good word for strength in Hebrew, and it really is, and again, there's actually several perfectly good words for strength in Hebrew, and none of them are used here. The word that's used here is arms. I'm going to cut off your arms, and in fact, the arms of your whole family. And you understand, it's not literal, really, right? But you understand what the problem is. The problem is the arms. Take it by force. All right, you want to use your arms that way? We can take care of that. Days are coming when you're not going to be able to do that anymore. I'm going to cut those things off. Right? I'm going to cut off your arms and, in fact, the arms of your whole family. And, of course, metaphorically, it means strength. I understand that. But it's really important to see how the metaphor is working, because the problems are exactly what God is going to be dealing with. It's not just sort of zapping people out of nowhere. The seeds that they sow are exactly the crops that they reap. And look, a time is coming when I will cut off your arms and the arms of your ancestors' family so that no one in your family will live to old age. And you remember part of the problem now is that he's old. This has been going on for a long time. You want to let things go on for a long time? Okay. We can take care of that. Nobody's going to be able to let things go on for a long time ever again. No one will ever live to an old age in her family. And then, in distress, you're going to look with a greedy eye on all the prosperity that will be bestowed upon Israel. And no one in your family will ever live to an old age. Huh? So, you want to look at holy things and use them for your own benefit? That's fine. We can take care of that. There's going to come a time in which you're going to look with a greedy eye on all the blessings, and you're not going to be able to participate in them. Again, it's really chilling. And for me, it's the chilling thing about this judgment. It's my opinion. One of the most beautiful, horrific judgment oracles in the whole Bible. And what makes it so horrific is that the things that are the problem are exactly how the judgment comes about. There's a beautiful, horrific balance to this. It's the bed that he's made, and now he lies in it. No one in your family will ever live to old age. And the only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar. So, maybe there'll be people that will, in your family, that will continue to be priests. But that one is going to weep out his eyes. And he's going to grieve his heart. All the members of your household are going to die by the sword. And the fate of your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, this is going to be a sign. Both of them are going to die on the same day. Bluebird, I will raise up for myself a faithful priest. I wonder who that might be. No, it's not Jesus. It's Samuel. I'm going to raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to everything that's in my heart and in my mind. And I will build him a sure house. That is, he's going to have descendants and they're going to follow right along with him. I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my anointed one forever. Everyone who's left in your family is going to come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread, and is going to say, please put me in one of the priest's places so that I can eat a morsel of bread. Just a morsel, just a crumb. You want to fatten yourselves? We can take care of that too. There'll come a time when anyone that's left is going to beg for a morsel of bread to eat. But there's going to be a faithful priest who's going to have descendants that are going to follow right along with him, and he's the one that I'm going to look at forever. He's the one that I'm going to use forever. Footnote, this isn't important. What I'm about to say is absolutely inconsequential. You understand that God has, in this very oracle itself, God has used the word forever before this ending. You understand the way whenever God uses the word forever, that doesn't necessarily mean forever. That means forever. As long as you just sort of, at least try to stay in the path, right? You sort of know what the plan is, and you sort of go along with the plan. If you take a right turn, and you wind up somewhere in the middle of Nevada, well, of course not. The forever implies some sort of a cooperation on your part, which is not what has happened with Eli, or obviously with his sons. And of course, you understand that the man of God doesn't come to Hophni and Phinehas. Because they're not really the problem. I mean, they're the problem. They're certainly not nice guys. But they're not really the problem. The real problem is Eli. Because he has the responsibility. And he's not doing it. So that's the end of the oracle. And you notice on the next page what Eli's response is. And Eli repented and cried to God and said, oh, I'm sorry, I will take care of things immediately, please have mercy. No, he doesn't say any of this. You notice what Eli's response is. Me, myself, if I had heard this oracle, I'll cut off your arms, you're going to weep your eyes out, no one's going to last to an old age. Anyone that does last to an old age is going to be begging for crumbs of bread. If I had heard an oracle like this, God, forgive me, right? I would have. This is chilling. You notice what Eli's response is? Nothing. However, there is a response, and the response is by the narrator. And the narrator's response is, take a look at Samuel. I wonder who that faithful priest might be. Now, the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli. Not ministering for his own needs, ministering to the Lord. The word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread. That's a really important line. Because what that line says is that what has just happened didn't happen. It's not like Eli could say, well, you know, I turned on religious broadcasting last night and I saw, you know, all of these people and they're sort of all saying very different types of things, and so I'm not quite sure who to believe, and I'm not quite sure where I should put my pledge, right? Right? No. What has just happened is unique. And because it's unique, and because Eli isn't doing anything about it, that's really bad. It's kind of like, for those of you who've had children, and you are in the car with them, and they're in the back seat, and they're bickering, and you're driving, and you can't stand it anymore, and you yell at them, and you say, shut up! I can't stand it! Stop bickering! If 5 minutes later, what you say is, shut up! Stop bickering! I can't stand it! I know something about their response to the first request. And that is, they didn't do anything about it. And so, just like this one, God sent a man of God to tell Eli, things are desperate. You better take care of things. Because it's not going to go well for you at all. Eli's response is not a response. And therefore, same song, second verse, could be better. It's going to get worse. So God speaks again. Second judgment. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see, but in fact, his eyesight has always been dim. I mean, not necessarily physically, but he couldn't see what's going on right under his eyes. And even if he did, even if he heard about it, he didn't care. But now he actually can't see. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see, was lying down in his room. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. All right, so yet again, you remember, again, quite a while ago, I guess it was with Exodus, we talked about the tabernacle. Right? Again, the tabernacle is not a big place, right? Not where you are, right? Again, it's not a big place. It's sort of divided into thirds, and that is one third of it is the holy place with the curtain. Behind the curtain is the the ark, right? The two thirds of it is, that's the most holy place. This is the holy place, and the holy place has three things in it. On the right hand side, right over here, we have a table with bread that we change daily. Holy bread. We have a golden altar right here that we offer incense in front of that curtain. And then over here, which is the whole point of this, is a lampstand. Well, of course it's a lampstand. I don't know if you've ever been in a tent, but it's dark in here, right? And so you need light, right? And so you light this lampstand, and the lampstand has seven things going across, seven lamps. So you're lighting this. The problem is that when you light it, it's not an ordinary lampstand. Right? It's a holy lampstand. We do this too! At the Episcopal Church of the Transfiguration, you remember when you go up and you're there above the altar, there's the lamp? And that lamp is always... You know where we get that from? That's where we get that from. It's the tabernacle. But the problem is that you light the lamps, right? And you can't put them out. You can't snuff them out when you're done with whatever it is you're doing inside the tabernacle, doing all your holy kind of stuff. You can't just sort of snuff them out because it's holy. And therefore you have to wait until all that oil is burnt up and it goes out by itself. And of course, the person who should be in charge of this is Eli. The priest. That's right, Eli. He's asleep, right? He's in his own place. And it's the boy, right? The boy Samuel, who's in it, just making sure the whole place doesn't burn down. Right, just there inside, Just making sure that the lamps go out nicely, right? But of course, he's in this place where the Ark of God is. And then we have a funny story. That's something also, and again, it's so much in my, maybe I like it because it's sort of my personality, and that is that he had this incredibly horrific judgment oracle by the man of God. And then we tell a funny story, right? And it's comic relief. That's what we call it. So here's a funny story. So there's the boy. He's in there in the tabernacle waiting. And then the Lord called, "Samuel, Samuel!" And he said, "Here I am." And he ran to Eli. And he said, "Here I am. You called me." And he said, "I didn't call. Go out on again." And so the boy goes back to the tabernacle, goes inside the tabernacle, and lies down. And the Lord calls again, "Samuel!" And Samuel got up and went to Eli, and he said, "Here I am," because he's hearing voices, right? And he thinks that it's the old man. The Lord called again, "Samuel," and Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." And he said, "I didn't call. Go lie down again," right? Just the well-crafted nature of this. We have two scenes, and again, it's the three little pigs scene here, right? Right, three little pigs went out. First one's straw sticks, and then the bricks have changed, right? This is the way we tell stories. What we have are the two scenes here, right, and they're kind of identical. There's one tiny little change, and I love this change because I think it's so, so important. Just notice this. In the first one, the Lord called, "Samuel, Samuel," and he said, "Here I am," and he, what did he do? What did he do? He ran. He ran to Eli. Zook! In the second one, Samuel got up and went to Eli. He doesn't run. It's like the old man's playing tricks again. Yeah. Right? It's, anyway, I thought that was hilarious. You can do it too. First of all, he runs, and then it's like, okay. So he went to Eli, and he said, "Here I am, you called me." He says, "I didn't call. I did not call, my son." "Buddy, don't you call him your son. I know your son." And there's not a bigger contrast in the whole Old Testament between your sons and this kid. But anyway, "I didn't call, my son. Go lie down again." Samuel didn't yet know the Lord because the word of the Lord hadn't been revealed to him. Again, he's the kid. It's so cute. I love that line, right? Samuel didn't yet know the Lord because the word of the Lord hadn't been revealed to him. I love that because you know what? It says something important about Samuel and about why he's doing this. But even more importantly, it says something about somebody else in our story. Eli. You see, Samuel doesn't know him. Samuel doesn't know the Lord. He's just a kid. The word of the Lord has never been revealed to him because he's just a kid. There's somebody else in our story that, in fact, should know God. And, in fact, there's somebody else in our story that, in fact, the word of the Lord has been revealed to. We just read it. You see, that little two-sentence parenthetical statement is actually, it does two different works, right? It works in two different ways. It talks about Samuel objectively. It also makes an important statement about Eli and reminds you about what's been going on with Eli on the other. So here's the house of bricks. The Lord called Samuel again, a third time. And he got up and he went to Eli and said, "Here I am because you called me." What a great little boy. I mean, it doesn't matter how often the old man's fooling him, right? Which is what he assumes at this point, right? He keeps going back. Me, myself? Nah. Right? "Here I am, you called me." And then Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the boy. My opinion, the most important word in that sentence is then. Then he realizes what's going on. It takes two times for him to realize, you're in a holy place. You're in a place where God dwells. You're hearing voices. I wonder what that might mean. Then light dawns on Marblehead, and Eli perceives that the Lord was calling the boy. And therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down, and if he calls you, you say, 'Speak, Lord, because your servant is listening.'" And so Samuel, and he went lay down in his place. And now the Lord came and stood there calling us before, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel said, speak, because your servant is listening. And that's where the reading usually stops when we read it in church. Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And then we pull out the guitar. Here I am, Lord. Is it I, Lord? Right? And we have whole sermons on vocation. And do you hear God calling you to do certain things? Do you hear God calling you to take care of the poor? Do you hear God calling you? Blah, 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 blah. Would you like to give your heart to Jesus? Blah, 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 blah. I'm wacky this way, but you know what? I think we should actually pay attention to what God says. Yeah. And not just sort of make up whatever we think God is saying. Here's what God says to the boy Samuel. The Lord said to Samuel, look, I'm about to do something in Israel that will make both ears of anyone who hears of it tingle. That doesn't mean anything to us. It's an idiom in Hebrew, and what the idiom, if I were to translate this into English, what I would say, the way I would put it into English is, look, I'm about to do something in Israel that will make both ears of anyone who hears of it bleed. This is not going to be a good thing. It's not going to be tickling their ears. It's going to be so horrible that it's going to make their ears buzz or bleed, or it's going to be not a good thing. On that day, I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end, because I have already told him that I'm about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew because his sons were blaspheming God and he didn't restrain them. You see, there it is. I mean, we actually have, right? It's his fault because he's not taking care. And therefore, I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house is not going to be expiated. It's not going to be forgiven. It's not going to be covered over. It's not going to be taken care of. It's not going to be done away with by sacrifice or offering forever. And you understand that that's the only way in which forgiveness occurs. That's the only way in which we have relationship with God. And I can tell you, as a good Episcopalian, that's the only way that we have relationship with God is through a sacrifice. But that's not important right now. This is horrific. This is horrific. He's been told by the man of God the judgment that is coming on him. Now, God tells the boy Samuel that in fact all that's coming to pass, and in fact there's no way to get out of it. This is sunk. Absolutely. There's no break now. Samuel lay there until the morning. And then he opened the doors to the house of the Lord. And Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. But Eli called Samuel and said, Samuel, my son. Ooh, there, it just drives me crazy when he does that. Samuel, my son. And he said, here I am. Oh my God, what a great kid. And Eli said, what was it that he told you? Don't hide it from me. May God so do to you and more also if you hide anything from me, all that he told you. Geez Louise, old man. It's like, what is that good? This is a guy with sort of anger issues, I think, right? Like, what did he say? What did he say? Don't you hide anything from me. Okay. And so Samuel told him everything. And in fact, he didn't hide anything from him. And Eli says, it's the Lord. Let him do whatever seems good to him. The old buddy. Let us confess our sins before Almighty God, right? Yeah, you can do whatever you want. Hey, God, whatever. Blah, 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 judgment. Blah, blah, blah. Again, absolutely no repentance, no recognition that this is actually really serious stuff. Just like before. So Samuel grew up, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. That's an interesting sentence there, because in Hebrew, actually, it's not one sentence. It's three sentences. And this sentence sort of sets up a lot of what's going to be going on for the next several weeks that we meet. Because this is what it says in Hebrew. Samuel grew up. The Lord was with him. He let none of his words fall to the ground. You notice that last sentence is ambiguous. I'm not sure what it's saying. Samuel grew up. I understand that. The Lord was with him. I understand that. He let none of his words fall to the ground. In other words, he didn't let any of his words go unfulfilled. I don't know what that means, because it means two different things. It can mean that, in fact, whenever God says something, Samuel fulfills it. On the other hand, it could also mean whenever Samuel says something, God makes sure it comes to pass. And I think it's intentionally ambiguous. All Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was a trustworthy prophet of the Lord. Anytime Samuel says something, they know that God was the one that originally said it. He's simply a speaker, a loudspeaker, a megaphone. God says it, he's faithful. He says it, he does it. The Lord continued to appear at Shiloh because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. So this keeps going on. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. That's not what I was expecting. What I was expecting is the word of the Lord came to all Israel. But you understand that the word of the Lord and the word of Samuel are the same thing, right? They support each other. It's like whenever God says something, Samuel simply repeats it. And whenever Samuel says something, obviously God has said it. And therefore, when it says the word of the Lord, it's actually the same thing as the word of Samuel, right? Anybody know algebra?
Yeah.
It's a funny thing because we have an equation here. I've just set up an equation for us. And that is the word of the Lord is the same thing as the word of Samuel. And the funny thing about algebra is that you can cancel out things that are the same on either side. So the word of, and so we actually are left with a sense that in fact it's the Lord that is Samuel. Samuel is God. Why are you looking at me so funny? Yeah, you see the danger of this. My opinion, that little ending to this story sets up all sorts of problems. And there are problems that the text is going to tease out for us in the upcoming stories. So keep that in mind. Just one really quick. In the next chapter, the Philistines fight against Israel. They become involved in a war. The Ark of God is taken. And guess what happens in the midst of that war? Guess what happens to Hophni and Phinehas? They die in one day. The messenger comes back to Shiloh, tells Eli. As soon as the messenger tells Eli, guess what happens to Eli? He dies. Mm-hmm. He dies in an interesting sort of way. He's sitting on a stool. Again, he's blind. The messenger comes. Eli says to him, "So what's the news of the war?" And the messenger says, "Well, in fact, your two sons died, Hophni and Phinehas. And the Ark of God was taken." He's sitting on a stool. Eli falls over and breaks his neck. And it's funny because the text does not say that he falls over and breaks his neck because he's old. It says that he falls off the stool and breaks his neck. And again, because he's fat. And you know how he got so fat? It's all of those sacrifices, all of that barbecue for all of those decades. Isn't God wonderful? The judgment comes, and in fact, the judgment is related exactly to sin. He makes the bed, and then he has to lie in it. So, anyway, so there we go. Next time we meet, we're going to talk more about Samuel. The next time we meet is going to be a chapter in which, guess what happens? Samuel is old. Ooh. And he has two sons. Oh. But we'll talk about that next time. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.